Welcome to The Connection, where humans and aliens converse, and where all the dots are connected. I'm Nancy of Zeta Talk, an emissary for aliens from Zeta Reticuli. They are here to warn of great cataclysms on Earth and advise how to survive this. The pending pole shift is not the end. Man will make his next leap forward to live a better time when aliens will live among us. Zeta Talk began in 1995 and was on the web by mid-year. In 1997, I, Nancy, copyrighted a script called The Passage, hoping to see this story on TV as perhaps a mini-series. Well, I got some interest from Hollywood producers over the years, but as the message Zeta Talk was putting out was to be suppressed, and many disinformation campaigns against Zeta Talk were already mustered, this never proceeded to production. I modified it to be a short story, hoping to see this as a series in a magazine or newspaper, but this also did not come to fruition. However, I made it available immediately on the web. You can click there and get it as a PDF and print it off. So it's available to the public to read in total. Just click on the title, The Passage, on the menu at upper left. A number of disaster movies had begun to emerge, each taken singly representing a minor subset of the pole shift phenomenon as described by the Zetas. According to my memory and research, the first seemed to be When the Earth Stood Still, a 1951 movie reflecting the time frame of Roswell, when the secret government first got the word that a pole shift was in the future and would involve a halt in the Earth's rotation. Could this be the reason for that theme? And I quote from the movie blurb, The Day the Earth Stood Still. The film soberly depicts the arrival of an alien dignitary, Klaatu, who's come to Earth with his deadly robot, Gort, to deliver the message that Earthlings must stop warring among themselves, or else. After being shot at by ignorant, panicked military guards, Klaatu is brought to a Washington, D.C. hospital, where he begs a sympathetic but frank Major White to gather all the world's leaders so he can tell them more specifically what he has come 250 million miles to warn them about. End of the quote. This same warning, the stopped rotation, has been included in Zeta Talk since the start, along with an explanation of what MJ-12 was told from the start of the Roswell days. And I quote from Zeta Talk, MJ-12 Agenda, written October 15, 2000. Seeing that the pole shift was rapidly approaching and was framing out to be the horror we had described during our initial encounters shortly after Roswell, MJ-12 set out to inform the public via the media, with movies having a cataclysmic overtone. Tidal waves, asteroids and missiles of death raining down upon cities from space, dust in the air putting the Earth in a death grip of doom, all these were designed to set the populace to thinking about such matters, but always with the theme that their government would and could save them. If the public was not informed at the start in these film scenarios, this was because panic was to be avoided, the best interests of the public in mind, or so the story went. MJ-12's initial approach to the problem of breaking the news to the public has also migrated over time to a different set of projects. End of the quote from Zeta Talk. Remember Star Wars, the big rage during the Reagan era, and something the current President Bush has been trying to revive? In that trash in the tail of Planet X is no secret, and the main danger for the government bunkers planned for the elite, those in power, the real reason was to deflect large rocks from a collision course with Earth. What was the next disaster movie to emerge? Meteor, written in 1979. And I quote from the movie blurb, As a 5-mile-wide asteroid hurtles toward the Earth, a scientist, the inventor of Hercules, a revolutionary satellite missile launching system, tries to warn the U.S. government of the impending danger. But because of his fanatical anti-Soviet sentiment, a general refuses to heed his warnings and turns the missiles away from their Soviet targets to aim them toward outer space. Now the scientist and his Soviet counterpart have to convince their stubborn governments that the meteor is a real danger to the entire planet and that they must destroy the menace before it hits home. End of the quote. And how close to the description of the real use Star Wars was to be put to does this sound? I quote from Zeta Talk, Star Wars, written July 1995. Are humans attempting to preempt the coming cataclysms by developing a Star Wars shield? Yes. This is the reason for all the press during the past decade or so for the Star Wars shield. What then is the unstated purpose of the Star Wars shield? The hope is that by putting up into the skies giant lasers, that the comet itself could be disabled by a direct hit. As this Planet X is massive, outweighing the Earth by several times, destruction would not be by physical means. The intention and the hope was to start some kind of a chain reaction that would cause the planet to blow itself up. The means by which this would happen has not yet been established, but the humans contemplating this wanted to get started anyway. End of the quote from Zeta Talk on Star Wars. Let's compare the description of how an uninformed public would react to the scenario that the Zetas were describing in 1995, as depicted in my short story, to the disaster movies that emerged in the mid-1990s and to the present day. First off, the cover-up is encountered, as that certainly has been in place since Roswell. In Chapter 1, after Danny, a young reporter, wants to cover what he considers a hot story about the weather and the real reason that the world is going haywire, an inbound planet, his editor tables it. I quote from the passage, Chapter 1, Theories. The editor of the Tribune moved slowly around his crowded office, his baggy pants wrinkled around the seat and sagging unevenly below the knee, announcing without fanfare the editor's priorities. The Tribune is successful, but the margin, as with all products that depend upon the fickle public, required a nervous eye. Zach may have found he had to be a politician more often than a reporter, and where this did not set well with his perfunctory personality, he had learned to accept this as a fact of life. Some news came with a price when printed. Zach eased into his worn leather chair, flipping the pages of a story laid on his chair seat with barely time enough to grasp their meaning. Glancing up through his bifocals at Danny, who had been watching from his desk and had come to lean in the doorway, the editor is brief and to the point. This won't fly. Danny frowns and slips into a wooden chair in front of the editor's desk, the defendant's chair, not meant to be comfortable. It'll get read. And who's going to pay the merchant for damages for that riot this might cause? Danny's frown deepens. I don't remember riots when the movie about asteroids came out. That was maybe. This isn't saying maybe. Zach Mia looked unblinkingly across the desk at Danny, peering up over his bifocals. Nukes aren't maybe. We've been living with them forever. Protests maybe, but not riots. The editor tosses the story across his desk to Danny, settling back into his chair. Nukes are still maybe. Someone has to push the button. You're not sitting in my chair, Danny, and I'm telling you, this won't fly. Danny scoops up the story, his mouth opening and closing as he processes and rejects arguments, blinks twice, and slowly rises and walks out the door without a comment. Outside the editor's office, he stops and is lost in thought, his face smooth, showing no emotion. Finally, he mutters, "Bullshit," and grabs his jacket and strides out of the office. End of the quote from the passage. In the late 1990s, disaster movies were trying to exonerate the cover-up by claiming it was for the public's good. "We'll tell you when we've got the problem solved," was the theme. In Deep Impact, released in 1998, the public remains remarkably calm when the president announces a lottery to determine what citizens will be moved into the bunkers. Government actually functions, too. Dream on. And I quote from the movie blurb on Deep Impact. A comet is on a fatal collision course with the Earth. In the weeks and months that follow, everyone in the world must struggle to find meaning for their lives in the face of looming catastrophe. A plan is set in motion to establish underground shelters, arcs in which the fortunate few may survive the impact, even if all other life on Earth is wiped out. As the day of cataclysm grows nearer, all the range of human reactions is evoked, from panic to noble resignation to fate. End of the quote. Armageddon, also released in 1998, had a similar theme. NASA will save the day. Meanwhile, the barely informed public remained calm. I guess the message was for the public to remain calm, as the government would surely save the day. And I quote from the movie blurb on Armageddon. An asteroid the size of Texas is heading directly toward Earth at 22,000 miles per hour. NASA's executive director has only one option, to send up a crew to destroy the asteroid. He enlists the help of the world's foremost deep core oil driller and roughneck team of drillers to land on the asteroid, drill into its surface, and drop a nuclear device into the core. In this heroic journey, they face the most physical and emotionally challenging conditions ever encountered to save the world and prevent Armageddon. End of the quote. At the start of Zeta Talk, due to the desire on the part of the Zetas to lead the Bush administration into their planned war in Iraq prematurely, the famous white lie ray, May 15, 2003. The pole shift was described as happening suddenly, the Earth slowing in its rotation to a stop within days, the pole shift happening after scant days of a stoppage, and with little warning other than a red dust descending through the atmosphere. Today we know that a severe Earth wobble will ensue, 3 days of darkness for the northern hemisphere, all prior to the slowing of rotation to a stop. But in the early days of Zeta Talk, the implication was that rotation slowing would be one of the first clues. And I quote from Zeta Talk, Stop Rotation, written July 1995. At first, your planet Earth reacts by additional swirling about in matter deep within its core. In the final days, as the giant comet begins passing between the Earth and its sun, total interference occurs. The Earth slows in its rotation and actually stops. This is recorded in written history and spoken folklore worldwide as a long day or night. The period of time, due to the lack of mechanical clocks, was not measurable, but the humans who experienced this described this as anywhere from a few hours to several days. The latter is more correct. End of the quote from Zeta Talk. As in the movie, The Day the Earth Stood Still, this event descends suddenly upon the populace. Disaster movies emerging since the mid-1990s and after the year 2000 reflected this sudden emergency of global crises also. The failure of government to even warn the public, despite the warnings of scientists and the pleading of conscientious bureaucrats, being a key point. The message? We got in this fix because, one, the government did something wrong, and two, the government considered the public last and their own political careers and corporate connections first. Sudden change affecting stunned city dwellers was anticipated, as the plan within the inner circles of government was to not say a word to the general public until the end. The movie Volcano, released in 1997, depicted a volcano suddenly erupting in L.A. And I quote from the movie blurb on Volcano. Los Angeles, the city which has become almost a byword for disaster, is about to experience its most cataclysmic event ever, one that will ultimately test its ability to survive. A vent in the Earth's crust has unleashed an incredible force of nature, an erupting volcano, and ground zero is L.A.'s famed La Brea Tar Pits. An unprepared Los Angeles is facing its worst nightmare as an endless stream of fiery, deadly lava insidiously creeps toward traffic-choked streets, while wrecking havoc below ground in the labyrinth of man-made and natural tunnels. End of the blurb. And who would expect earthquakes in New York? Released in 1999, Aftershock depicted just that. And I quote from the movie blurb on Aftershock, Earthquake in New York. After an aftershock tears through New York City, turning it into a fiery concrete wasteland, the mayor and a former fire chief must set aside their political differences to wrench Manhattan out of the ashes. Chaos reigns, and survivors struggle to stay alive, above ground and below. End of the blurb. And a quote from the short story, The Passage, Chapter 2, Signs. Life goes on, even in the face of the inexplicable. On the trading floor of the stock exchange, there are shouts and traders running to and fro with cell phones to their ears, but the floor is uncharacteristically empty and quiet. Traders and dealers are standing around, staring at the big clock, which now reads 11:11. People are huddling in small groups, talking quietly with each other. The TV monitors hung from the ceiling are tuned to CNN teams talking about the daybreak, hours late. Out on the busy street, a drug dealer who would normally move through the crowd rapidly, making his contacts and moving to safer streets, stands with his back against a brick wall, eyes scanning the sky, cigarette in hand. A bum comes up to bum a smoke and is absentmindedly handed the pack by the dealer, complete with lighter. An executive in a dark gray suit steps out of a cab, smooth black briefcase in hand. He notices the fine red dust powdering the sidewalk and squats to pick up a pinch between his fingers, rubbing his fingers together. The fine dust is everywhere now, blowing off the tops of moving cars, settling into cracks in the sidewalks, and coming down onto the anxious, upturned faces like a fine mist. End of the quote from the short story, The Passage. Another early Zeta warning was that the weather would get steadily worse and that climate change would come suddenly during the hour of the shift. And I quote from Zeta Talk, Heralding, written July 1995. Changes have already begun and are known to your scientists and meteorologists. Violent storms, unusual weather patterns, severe and long-lasting droughts, increased frequency of hurricanes, torrential rains, and a general warming of the planet. This is all cast in the category of global warming. End of the quote from Zeta Talk. But until the weather actually started to document the accuracy of this warning, disaster movies did not follow. And the message that government could be expected to be foot-dragging, issuing warnings too late, and looking out for their own skins was certainly being given. And I quote from the movie blurb on Day After Tomorrow, released in 2004. What if we are on the brink of a new ice age? This is the question that haunts climatologists. Research indicates that global warming could trigger an abrupt and catastrophic shift in the planet's climate. The ice cores drilled in Antarctica show that it happened before, 10,000 years ago. And now they're warning officials that it could happen again if they don't act soon. But his warning comes too late. Then a series of increasingly severe weather events starts to unfold around the globe. Hail the size of grapefruit batters Tokyo. Record-breaking hurricane winds pound Hawaii. Snow falls in New Delhi. And then a devastating series of tornadoes whips through Los Angeles. Global warming has pushed the planet over the edge and into a new ice age. New York City must now cope with severe flooding and plummeting temperatures in Manhattan. Full-scale, massive evacuations to the south begin. End of the quote. Remember the depiction of VP Dick Cheney in Day After Tomorrow? Even with the weather swinging out of control, defending the oil industry's interests as being of greater importance. And in Category 7, both the government edicts to FEMA to protect government installations first, and the opportunistic evangelists looking to feather their pockets first, were faulted for not considering the public welfare. And I quote from the movie blurb on Category 7, released in 2005. As the ultimate superstorm continues to build in size and begins to ravage the rest of the world, FEMA's newly appointed director has her hands full preparing for a cataclysmic storm in the U.S. Up in the sky, pilots fly above the storm to try to find what in the atmosphere is causing the storms. Meanwhile, a television evangelist and his wife, preying on the fears of a storm-battered nation, begins to broadcast alarming warnings of biblical plague. As the predictions begin to come true, the deadly storm continues to wreak havoc worldwide, culminating in a record-setting Category 7 superstorm over Washington, D.C. End of the quote. And I quote from the short story, The Passage, Chapter 2, Signs. The room is dark, lights off, as a private conversation is going on. Standing in the shadows is a middle-aged man, fit with no signs of middle-aged spread or slack muscles. A military man, Colonel Cage considers fit the first bastion of discipline. Tightly disciplined, he lives by the rules both military and personal, which often are at war with each other. The colonel is not alone. He is talking to a figure taller than he, bone thin, with an enormous head seemingly too heavy for the stick-thin body. But there is grace in the motions made by the long, lanky arms, and the colonel seems not to notice or be alarmed by the shape of his companion. He has long been accustomed to conversing with this visitor from Zeta Reticuli. Where a conversation is going on, only the voice of the colonel can be heard, yet the intensity of the words shows that an interaction of ideas is clearly going on. We can't tell them. Don't think I don't want to. It's orders. And orders are orders. The colonel breaks down a bit, moving his hands in front of him in an emotional way, as though groping for an answer, a resolution that will not come. My God, don't you think I want my neighbor's children safe? They practically live at my house, but if I say anything, I'll disappear. What will my Mary and the kids do then, for God's sake? End of the quote from the short story, The Passage. Massive global earthquakes which spare no continent or country were described in Zeta Talk, Richter 9 everywhere. And I quote from Zeta Talk, Pole Shift, written July 15, 1995. The pole shift is therefore sudden, taking place in what seems to be minutes to humans involved in the drama, but which actually takes place during the better part of an hour. There are stages between which the human spectators in shock are numb. At first, there is a vibration of sorts, a jiggling as the crust separates in various places from the core. End of the quote from Zeta Talk. By 2005, disaster movies were not only reflecting the reality of an awakened and restless volcano at Yellowstone, news that was suppressed in 2003 when it began to get restless, but also violent continent-adjusting earthquakes. The made-for-TV movie Yellowstone, Supervolcano, released in 2005, openly discussed the correlation to real changes that had occurred at least a year before at Yellowstone. Once again, the government was shown to be late in warning the public, and politicians concerned about their own careers first. Avoiding panic, even when this ultimately resulted in the deaths of millions, was just the rule of the day. And I quote from the movie blurb on Yellowstone Supervolcano. Amidst the stunning wilderness of Yellowstone National Park, steam and hot water bubble and hiss from thousands of colorful, mineral-encrusted springs and vents. These hot springs, geysers, and bubbling mud pools are all outward manifestations of a huge body of magma residing not far beneath the surface. It's a subterranean sea of molten lava that scientists are sure will burst forth through the Earth's crust. It's just a question of when. Based on the predictions of top volcano experts and detailed planning and evacuation strategies of government agencies, this sobering factual drama shapes possible events into a compelling human experience. End of the quote. The made-for-TV movie 10.5 appeared to be warning the public that massive quakes affecting the shape of a continent could and would occur. and I quote from the blurb for 10.5, released also in 2005. When an earthquake strikes California, breaking all records and surpassing measurements on the Richter scale, it's up to an academic earthquake research scientist to apply her contested theories to reality, saving the West Coast from imminent destruction. While her controversial ideas and efficient take-charge attitude cause infighting among her fellow scientists, the president and his team scramble to evacuate the coast before it is effectively shattered by the natural disaster. End of the quote. And I quote from the short story, The Passage, Chapter 3, The Horror. Big Tom is walking back from the spring house with a bucket of water in his hand. The pumps have stopped, are stopping repeatedly due to the erratic power supply coming off the grid lines, the switches tripping as soon as the reset button is pushed. Big Tom stops in his tracks, feeling a slight but continuous tremble in the ground. His wife Martha comes running out of the house and into his arms, the buckets now dropped to the ground, sloshing and spilling over. The kids are running up behind her, crying, "Mom, Mom!" Panic is in the air. Danny and Red come from round the corner of the house, from the garden, onions and tomatoes for the gumbo Martha was preparing in their hands. Red's pale face accentuates the red tinge in his graying hair. He says, "The moon is on the move." Suddenly, everyone standing is thrown several feet. Big Tom is thrown backwards, skidding on his rear, Martha on top of him. Tammy sits up, holding her scraped and bleeding elbow, rocking back and forth in pain and crying hard. Billy staggers to his feet, standing pale and shaken, his arms out to either side and slightly crouching. Big Tom, rolled up into a sitting position and easing his wife to the side, frowns and said, "What the hell?" The barn, laid on a concrete slab, has been lurched off its foundations and moved halfway onto the sloping barnyard. The house has crinkled in the middle, the walls folding in on a broken support but still glued to its foundation. A massive split in the earth begins ripping across the fields behind the barn, opening and closing again, yawing open several feet, and then quickly closing again. The sky darkens as a hailstorm of what appears to be gravel starts peppering the landscape. The group, reacting to their injuries and shock in the yard, put their hands over their heads and dash back and forth, needing shelter but leering of going into the broken house. Lightning crackles overhead repeatedly, though there's no rain, and in the distance there's a whooshing sound as a falling blanket of fire drops on some trees along a stream, setting them ablaze. End of the quote from the short story, The Passage. Theta Talk had warned from the start that the public must get into self-sufficiency, not rely on their government to feed and rescue them. And I quote from Zeta Talk, Self-Sufficiency, written April 1999. There will be no security blanket that the populace can rely upon, so self-reliance must be the rule. The panic that will settle into governments as the time approaches, when each individual will be dealing with their own personal panic and anxieties, is completely unpredictable. It may run in all manner of directions. The movies that have been put out of late, where asteroids are falling and a calm prevails, and the government is like a rock of logic and quietly empties towns or flies people up to blow up asteroids, is so far from the truth as to be ludicrous. You will have your military running down the halls and bumping into each other, leaving their posts, turning guns on themselves and others. It is totally unpredictable. What will a frightened animal do when cornered? Well, your entire government and bureaucracies will turn into that in the last few months, so the populace should not look to them, but rather to themselves. End of the quote from Zeta Talk on self-sufficiency. In Yellowstone, Supervolcano, released in 2005, the inadequacy of a three-day supply of food and water is admitted. A walk to life is required to get those trapped out of the ash zones, and millions die. I quote from the short story, The Passage, Chapter 3. The group at the farmhouse has constructed a makeshift tent set up over a rope strung between trees, weighed down by rocks along the edges of blankets hung over the rope. Bedding of all kinds has been stuffed inside the tent, with some laundry hung on another rope strung nearby. Life goes on. A fire is smoldering between some stones, and a pot is hung on a hook overhead. Some metal from the wrecked barn used to rig a metal beam over the fire. A menage of wooden chairs salvaged from the house is set near a table with three legs, the fourth corner stabilized on a barrel. And from Chapter 4. In the dim light of the continuous dawn, Big Tom is trudging back from the creek, a towel thrown over his shoulder. Red is sipping coffee at the makeshift kitchen table, both men alone as the others sleep in. Big Tom glances up at the sky and says quietly to Red, "Seems like this cloud cover is never going to lift." Red rubs the tips of his fingers together, examining them briefly, and says, "I saw this when I was stationed in the Philippines. Some volcanoes have been burping somewhere." And from Chapter 5, Billy is out digging for potatoes in a field behind the tent city. It's gloomy as though early dawn, the trees along the creek starkly outlined against the gray sky. Their leaves have fallen off, not as they do in the fall when they color and then drop, but because about half have turned a sickly yellow and dropped while the remaining are still green. Billy is scraping and chopping at the earth with a short hoe and digging tool, turning the earth looking for potatoes. He has a cloth sack on the ground beside him, lumpy with the few potatoes he has found. He's dusty and frankly dirty in places, as much from his work as from infrequent baths. And from Chapter 5 again. Though it's still midday, it's still gloomy, as though a very overcast day during early dawn. Martha's sorting laundry, looking for items to be mended, seated on a chair in an open area, the laundry scattered about her in little piles on the ground. Issues around the food shortage and what to eat have come up continually lately, with creative meal-making resulting. Martha cooks what she and Red decide is good to eat, and the others are told not to ask. This has included atypical menus such as earthworms picked up off the damp grass after the last rain, and some slow-moving possums Red has caught, as well as edible weeds. Big Tom strides out to talk to his wife, squatting before her so they can talk face to face. He looks up into her face and says, "We're out, plumb out, and the canned goods are going fast, too." Martha's unperturbed as she and Red notice this long before the others. She keeps on mending through all of this without missing a stitch, though looks up into her husband's eyes a lot, letting him know she has heard him. She smiles. "Red's bringing some possum back, and I've got some special soup tonight. You'll see, it'll be all right." Big Tom pauses, then rises to his feet. "Special soup?" Martha starts picking the laundry up off a pile, folding it on her lap as though getting ready to go, and says, "Never you mind, it'll be good for you." And again from Chapter 5. It's supper time in the tent city, where the group is gathered around a glowing campfire in the center of the makeshift tents. Martha is ladling out soup, handing bowl after bowl to the group as they come up one at a time. Some members of the group eat heartily, others sniff and ask, "What's this?" but receive no answer or even a nod from Martha. All eventually start eating. End of the quote from the short story, The Passage. Zeta Talk warned early that the government would want to impose martial law, the elite among them wanting to set up kingships in the future after the pole shift. In that the White House was taken by Supreme Court appointment in the year 2000 and by voter fraud in 2004, and in that Jeb Bush has been suggested by his father as a replacement for George W. in 2008, the term president for life seems apropos. In the post-disaster movie, Escape from L.A., released in 1996, just such a president for life had emerged, with L.A. becoming a prison colony. And a quote from the movie blurb on Escape from L.A. Los Angeles has finally had the really big earthquake everyone was afraid of, and what remains is now an island. Because the country's ultra-religious president for life wants it that way, all the weirdos and freaks that previously inhabited New York in large numbers and the rest of the U.S. in smaller concentrations have been quarantined on the island of L.A. End of the quote. Would cities be blocked, those termed useless eaters prevented from escape during the polar shift? Homeland Security's color-coded system allowed for citizens to be ordered to stay in their homes if a level red was called, and tests to see if the citizenry would cooperate have occurred. And I quote from ZetaTalk, Blockade Test, written March 27, 2004. The Homeland Security threat levels were, as many have suspected, not laid out with terrorism in mind, but the coming catastrophes preceding rotation stoppage in the pole shift. Those who have known for decades that Planet X was approaching and likely to cause the disasters we have predicted have not run screaming down the streets, quit their jobs, stopped paying their bills, or committed suicide. Yet this rationale that a public hearing the news would do such things is used as the excuse for not informing the public. As we have repeatedly explained, the plan was to entrap tens of millions within the U.S. coastal or river basin cities and force them to drown. What purpose, truly, is served by a level red alert in the fight against terrorism? Mothers without baby food, the ill unable to get to a doctor, and emergency personnel pointing their guns at those desperate folks as though they were the terrorists. End of the quote from ZetaTalk. And I quote from the short story, The Passage, Chapter 4, Stories. Mark is telling the group what he heard on the radio before their small plane hit rough up and down drafts due to incipient hurricane winds at the shift. The winds were like a hurricane, but different, more erratic. Our plane hit some bad drafts. I couldn't hold it. We could hear the radio news guy talking about it, too. Where the bridge crosses the river, cars were abandoned, blocking traffic in both directions. People were flooding across from both directions, desperate. Little kids were left abandoned. Rioting was breaking out, everyone in a hurry and no one knowing where to go, I guess. Trying to get someplace, any place, but where they were. And looting in the city. The police weren't just around, at least not paying attention. No law and anything goes. Mark's face is like a mask as he relays all this, keeping his emotions disconnected so he can get through it. Services were failing as people failed to turn up for their jobs and power outages went unrepaired. Phone lines went dead, gas pumps were locked, and the stations closed. Mark shakes his head and says, "A never-ending mid-morning on the East Coast taking its toll." Mark pauses a minute, keeping his emotions in control. We saw some of that, too, from the plane. Cars were littering the roads, pulling over to the side, out of gas or blocked. And there was a bridge with traffic lined up on both sides, blocked by abandoned cars in the bridge. This traffic jam was getting worse, too, cars pulling up at both ends. We could see people walking in small groups across the land, too, setting out on foot. And all the while, we could hear the earth moaning. I don't think I'll ever forget that sound. Big Tom nods in agreement. Mark glances at him for a minute and then continues. We heard that religious groups thought the end of the world had come, and lots of them, even atheists, were committing suicide, taking their whole families with them, taking the kids out first, just like that Jim Jones crowd. End of the quote from the short story, The Passage. The issue of opportunistic Mad Max gangs emerging as the infrastructure of government crumbles came up early on ZetaTalk, as a concern expressed by those asking questions of the Zetas. And I quote from ZetaTalk, Government Collapse, written July 1995. We are not describing a world where the established government is likely to continue as it was. We are describing a world where new forms of governing will emerge. The type will depend on the nature of the group of people. As we have detailed, there will be an increasing separation of service to other from service to self. For those groups oriented increasingly to service to self, no law or corps of police could hold the self-serving actions in check. There, the rule of law is supplanted by the rule of the strong. End of the quote from ZetaTalk. Disaster movies depicting this type of setting, Mad Max gangs emerging due to government collapse, occurred early. The reason for collapse was always somewhat vague. The 1995 Waterworld film simply referring to something the ancients did to cause the world to be flooded. And I quote from the blurb on the movie Waterworld. Imagine a future without dry land. a future where the Earth, covered in water, has evolved into a gritty nautical society held together by determination and ingenuity. The inhabitants of this once flourishing planet cling to life on incredible floating cities, their existence constantly threatened by bands of marauding pirates who roam the featureless surface of Waterworld. End of the quote. In a 1997 release, The Postman likewise inferred something vague, perhaps biological warfare, but the result was a rogue military unit, a self-appointed general, setting himself up as a king. And I quote from the blurb on the movie Postman. In the year 2013, civilization has been nearly decimated. No government remains, and most of the population struggles to survive. Groups of armed men vie for control, even dominance, of their surroundings. An army of warriors led by a despotic general is determined to keep the people apart and their spirits empty so they can continue their reign of terror. A lone drifter discovers a mail carrier's old rusted jeep. Inside, he finds a sack full of undelivered mail and the driver's uniform. Hoping it will make it easier for him to get food and shelter from the townspeople nearby, he dons the uniform and presents himself as the postman, a representative of the restored government of the United States. To the people he encounters, the postman and the letters he carries serve as a reminder of the way they once lived their lives. Slowly, a new spirit begins to take hold in their hearts. The mail the postman carries has become a symbol of hope. More important, it gives the citizens the courage to battle the general's army to regain control of the country. End of the quote. And I quote from the short story, The Passage, Chapter 5, Friend and Foe. In the wooded hills fringing the valley, quiet preparations have taken place. The military, it seems, were not taken by surprise. They prepared for this day with construction supplies and have quickly completed the construction of a dome with military hands assigned to the duty. The dome design is one fashioned after the remnants on sites on the Moon and Mars, scientifically studied to withstand high winds, earthquakes, and large enough to enclose their own atmosphere with comfort to the inhabitants. General Flood, a vein in his bull neck throbbing, is impatient. I wanted this done yesterday. We can expect stragglers to start arriving, and I'll be damned if they'll find us out in the open. His non-commissioned companion, Sergeant Hammond, is hurrying to catch up to the general. Shorter and slight of build, he looks up at the general and says in a worried voice, Sir, I haven't been able to get through to my wife and kids. None of us have. The general snaps back, I told you that'd have to wait. We've got bigger worries than that right now. End of the quote from the short story, The Passage. And what of Mad Max gangs rampaging the world after a disaster, no government or police force able to contain them? Zeta Talk has stated that these gangs will be contained by the survivors themselves. Vigilantism. The victim taking charge and not waiting for the missing long arm of the law. And I quote from Zeta Talk, Thug Control, written July 3, 2004. Where travel is difficult, as it will be everywhere after the shift, isolated villages will not be raided, and the thugs, likewise isolated, decimate themselves, each trying to be the survivor at the expense of the others. Eventually, survivor groups that remain are hard at work, all growing or catching their food and cooperating heavily with each other. The occasional lone thug is encountered and either runs for his life to live in the woods on his own, with survival very iffy, or he is killed attempting to loot the hard-working group. After the shift, with police and the military absent, phones dead, and determination of who the criminal and the victim are clear, standing back and letting the criminal have his way is not the option that is taken. Imagine trials where the victims of crimes determine the sentence, and you see the future of service-to-self gangs looting survival groups. End of the quote from Zeta Talk. The movie Mad Max, released in 1979, depicts this situation, with the police not even trying to control rebel biker gangs. And I quote from the blurb on Mad Max. Rebel bikers combat the police in a bleak post-nuclear future where the highways are bloody battlegrounds. When a gang of motorcyclists brutally murder a policeman's family, he becomes Mad Max, Avenger of the Highways. End of the quote. And I quote from the short story, The Passage, Chapter 4. I was at the Clearwater Resort, waiting it out as the phones had gone dead and no one knew what was happening. I was up in my room, changing, when I heard a woman's voice pleading, "Not my babies, please, they're so little." Then I heard gunshots, then silence, and slipped under the bed, quiet as a mouse. It was the Grogan brothers. I later realized they'd killed the other guests for target practice when they came up from the fishing hole. Almost everyone went there to escape the heat, you know. I saw them when I went to the barn to get my bay, fishing poles and fish in hand, laying there in blood and twisted in agony, all dead. I realized they were shooting everybody, and I'd be no exception. As the hours passed, Nettie determined that the Grogan brothers were downstairs getting drunk. They were laughing about what they'd done, laughing, talking about how people looked when the bullets hit, how they reacted, the look on their faces. Then they'd howl and carry on. I was sick, a trembling so hard I was afraid to move. I edged under the bed and lay there trying not to breathe, not to move, not to make any sound that would be heard. Now, considering themselves masters of the resort they were never welcomed at, the Grogan brothers swaggered around, putting their muddy boots up on the stuffed furniture and raiding the bar and tossing empty bottles at lamps and vases. No phones, no law, and the brothers can do as they please. I heard them say, "This is more fun than moving weed." Then I heard them moving from room to room, seeing what they could find. I held my breath when they came into my room, didn't breathe, and they missed me. Later I slipped down the stairs when it got quiet. They were asleep, drunk, and snoring. I went to the barn and saddled my bay. He follows me like a baby after I pet him a bit, quiet as a mouse. I thought I had gotten away and walked along the hedge where they couldn't see me unless I mounted, and I didn't mount to ride until beyond the trees there. But when I was riding away, I thought I saw something moving near the house. I figured I'd been seen. They chased me, and there was no hiding as the sun never went down. But it was dim, and that helped me. They had to use the headlights on their Jeep, or they would have lost me. I was the only living witness to their crime, and they weren't about to lose me. Dead women tell no tales. But I think they were on a power trip, too. Their guns ruled, I guess. These guys are sadistic. Once they get on top, no telling what they'd do. Big Tom is leaning against a large tree trunk, his rifle resting on a lower branch. The sound of a Jeep is heard in the distance, engines revving and the voices of young males whooping it up as though on the hunt for a prey that can't get away. The open-top Jeep is seen bouncing along a dirt road through the field, moving in the direction that the house and rider had taken, following the trail of dust puffs seen from a distance and the occasional prints left from pounding hooves. Big Tom lowers the rifle, moving his eyes close to the sight, bracing himself against the tree trunk. A shot rings out as Big Tom jerks from the recoil. End of the quote from the short story, The Passage. Theta Talk warned from the beginning of sloshing oceans that would inundate the coastlines for hundreds of miles. And I quote from Theta Talk, Flood Tide, written June 2001. This is a flood tide, with the lip of the water being at its highest point, rising like a silent tide endlessly on the rise, the wave rolling inland without a crashing back and forth, just a steady, progressive inundation. To those at the mercy of such a flood tide, their first thought is to climb above the tide. Soon they're standing on the highest point they can reach, and still the water, flowing inland steadily, rises. End of the quote from Theta Talk. Where this is described as a flood tide rising steadily and not a crashing giant wave coming down from above, disaster movies depict giant waves. In The Perfect Storm, released in the year 2000, the wave the fishing boat must rise above looks as high as a skyscraper, and the boat is eventually vertical to the ocean just before it goes under the waves. And I quote from the blurb for the movie Perfect Storm. In the fall of 1991, Captain Billy Tyne piloted his boat and his crew out to the fishing grounds of the North Atlantic. 2 weeks later, a confluence of severe weather, a perfect storm, gathered. With barely enough time to warn the vessels at sea, the storm bore down on New England. Captain Billy never received the warning. End of the quote. And, of course, there was the inundation of New York City during the movie Day After Tomorrow. Again, a giant wave. I quote from the short story, The Passage, Chapter 6. Mark is almost surprised to find the plane wreck looking as they had left it. The plane nosed into trees at the edge of the creek, the propellers twisted and one wing bent at a right angle. Mark and Brian are walking toward the plane hurriedly, while Mark is talking excitedly. Remember that air balloon jet I was taking to the club? I'll bet we can rig something up. We've got the parachutes, and heck, if we can just get out of this earthquake zone. Mark and Brian are floating through low-lying cloud. All is gray, and they both are being powdered with the fine volcanic soot that has turned the pair and their clothing light gray and streaked. Brian is hanging down below Mark in a parachute seat, looking around with wide, frightened eyes. Mark is holding the hot air jet gingerly in his hands, pointing up into the double parachute arranged above him. He rarely puffs the jet as the wind catches them and propels them with rapid bursts now and then. Mark is using the jet sparingly. Only when the wind dies down in between bursts, they begin to drift toward the ground. Below them are flooded farmlands and towns, a church steeple in a silo sticking up above the water, and occasional rooftops with people huddled in the center. One who waves frantically at the floating pair, hoping to be rescued. Off to the side in the distance is a new cliff where the land has been sheared upward by a couple hundred feet. Shreds of city housing are clinging to the top of the new cliff, as well as crumbled along the bottom, with wreckage clinging to the cliff itself. The day is continuously overcast, gray with blowing clouds almost at ground level, and drizzling continuously. Mark and Brian have floated to an approach to New York City. The wind, prevailing westerlies, are dragging them along at a fairly rapid clip, the parachute ahead of them and filled out like a sail. Brian has pulled his legs up and appears to be pulling himself up into a fetal position, his arms around his knees, his long hair floating out in the wind. Mark is excited. Brian, there it is. There's the city. We're home, home. We got to start bringing this down. Mark is looking up while he positions his hands on the ropes. When he glances down to mentally prepare his descent path, a grim look comes over his face. The Statue of Liberty is tilted at a 45-degree angle, with the remnants of a sailboat caught in and dangling from the frame. Seaweed shreds up to her chin. No high-rises remain standing, but the city skyline looks like a rubble instead, black in outline against the gray skies. Bridges are disconnected, with most sections down. No boats are seen in the water, but a couple large ocean-going vessels can be seen floating, bottom up. Mark's eyes have filled with tears, and he glances upward, not wanting to look down. Finally, he glances down to check on Brian, saying to himself, "At least you're not there to see all this. Time to say goodbye. Nothing left to live for." Mark points the hot air jet directly at the parachute lines, melting them one by one, and the rig begins to tip to the side, suddenly dropping into the ocean floor below. End of the quote from the short story, The Passage. So what do you think? Did this disaster script made available to the public in 1997 parallel and even precede the disaster movies that have emerged since the mid-1990s? And more importantly, did the content of Zeta Talk made available in 1995 parallel and even precede these disaster movies? That concludes our broadcast. Thank you for being with us. Remember to carry love in your heart. It's the commodity of the future. As the Zetas say, love may have a blooming going into the shift, as it ought, those with great love in their hearts responding to the realization that little else matters.